Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Duane Wirth, United States Representative on the Council of the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, which develops and promotes standards and practices for the safety, security, and environmental sustainability of international civil aviation. Ambassador Wirth will deliver the 2012 Charles W. Durham Distinguished Lecture, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Aviation Institute. He is also this year's recipient of the William F. Shea Award for Contributions to Aviation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 27, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Scott Vlasic, the director of the UNO Aviation Institute.
The Charles Durham Distinguished Lecture Series is one of the oldest events for the Aviation Institute. The event was in honor of Mr. Charles Durham, one of the co-founders of the Aviation Institute, along with Don Smithy, then the executive director of the Omaha Airport Authority. They saw a need for a program in the Omaha area that would deliver a high-quality professional aviation program. And now in its 22nd year, the Aviation Institute continues to be a leader in that area. Before I continue, I would like to introduce a few people. First, I'd like to introduce our former Aviation Institute directors that are here, our founding director, Mr. Bill Shea. And Dr. Scott Terry. We have our faculty emeritus, Denny Atchison, up here in the front row. And our Aviation Institute faculty, Dr. Pat O'Neill, Mr. Dave Smith, and Dr. Rebecca Ludi. So, unfortunately, Dr. Byers could not be with us this evening because he had a death in his family. I'd also like to recognize and give thanks to a few people that really helped make this event possible today. She's giving me the cutoff back there. It's Gail Loki, Ms. Sarah Martin, and Ms. Liz Barnhart. So thank you. I'd like to make one more recognition, and that is the Nebraska Department of Aeronautics Director, Mr. Ronnie Mitchell. I would now like to invite Dean John Bartle to come forward to say a few words on behalf of the university.
Thanks, Scott, and it's good to see so many people here today. It's a great occasion. As Scott mentions, the Institute is 22 years old, and 20 years ago, it's not that long ago, at least it didn't seem like it to me. For the younger folks, it may seem like a longer time, but when you think of 20 years ago, so there was no Aviation Institute here. Bill, you can remember that, or 22 years ago, but let's say 20 is a round number. But also think about how UNO has changed, how this area has changed. Here. Where we are right now, of course, was a racetrack. south of here, which, the area south of center, of course, is poised to develop. UNO will be developing its sports facilities there, a hockey arena, baseball and softball fields as well. and the buildings on North Campus have developed. Our college is building the College of Business, right up here, as well as information science, technology, and so on. So the physical manifestation of the university has really been dramatic, even in the last 10 years, much less 20 years. but I think more important than that is what goes on at the university. This sort of an event, of course, wouldn't have happened when there was no Aviation Institute, but I would even venture to say that maybe even 10 or 15 years ago, a focus on international aviation and bringing the ambassador of ICAO here to campus, might well not have happened. We're now a doctoral research university, which puts us in the top 300 universities by that classification. And that happened in large part because of doctoral programs in our college and in other colleges that have really, that are the criteria that the Carnegie Institution uses to get us there. So I mentioned these points just to point out to everybody to help, even those of us who are here on a regular basis, but to help us remember how much things have changed in the recent past. And when you think about how much things are going to change into the future, it's, I think for UNO, for Omaha, it's going to be very exciting times. And for the students here, this will be your careers as they develop. And so learning about an organization like ICAO is very important because aviation is not just a domestic industry anymore. Of course, it hasn't been for many years, but the international part of aviation has become so important that I'm delighted that the students will be here and be thinking about these issues and talking about them in your classes because they will affect your careers as they go through. Many of the issues that ICAO deals with are really cutting-edge, futuristic issues for the whole industry. And so it's a really a wonderful occasion. It's exactly the sort of thing a university should do, bringing an important person here to share their wisdom with future generations and helping us then think about how we're going to move forward. So it's not my job to introduce the ambassador, so I'll hold off on that, but I'm certainly delighted that he's able to come and delighted that all of you are here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean Bartle. The Aviation Institute has had another tremendous year, which started off in August with the presentation of the Loening Trophy. The Loening Trophy is for the most outstanding collegiate aviation program in the country, and this past May, two of our students, Zach Osino and Deanna Stoddard, did a presentation where UNO was victorious in winning this prestigious award. The Loening Trophy dates back to 1929, where Grover Loening saw the need for the development and competition within collegiate aviation programs. And two of his first judges were tremendous heroes within the aviation realm, Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart. And UNO is now forever linked to that trophy. I will add that the trophy is on display out at the Strategic Air and Space Museum until April. And if you have not had an opportunity to see that, I would encourage you to go out and take a look at that. The UNO flight team also had another successful year. While they did not win for the fourth year in a row the first place of the regional competition, they did come in third place and will be heading to Ohio State University in May for the national competition. On Friday of this week, we have a group of students that will be going up to Minneapolis to do a behind-the-scenes tour of the Minneapolis International Airport, and we are excited for them to get that opportunity. This fall has also been very important for us because we received our new flight training device, our Redbird, which is a full-motion flight training device that we got tremendous support from the university to acquire, and we are very excited to be integrating that into our new flight flight training curriculum. Additionally, this fall semester we had a 16% increase in enrollment, which we are very excited about. And finally, our faculty have been doing a number of tremendous things. And one initiative that I want to point out, in large part because of who our guest speaker is tonight, is an initiative that we are working with ICAO on, and that is the International Civil Aviation Organization. And Dr. O'Neill and Dr. Ludi are working with them on doing a training needs analysis for the member states of ICAO. And this is something that we are very excited about. Dr. Ludi just came back from Montreal last week where they are going to be formalizing an agreement, it looks like, between the university and ICAO. So we are extremely excited about that. And we'll be looking at going into, for the first phase, into South America, into Colombia and Brazil. So I will continue to update you on that as we have more information. So as I previously mentioned, the Durham Lecture dates back to the beginning of the Aviation Institute. Originally called Aviation 2000, it was designed to look into the future. The future looks extremely bright, especially on an international level today. The need for qualified mechanics, pilots, air traffic controllers is tremendous. The FAA recently stated that they will need to hire 1,000 controllers a year for the next 10 years. Some reports estimate that over 300,000 pilots will be needed worldwide over the next 15 to 20 years. Tonight's guest speaker can truly speak to the growth and demand of highly trained professionals in the aviation industry. Ambassador Wirth was appointed by President Barack Obama as the U.S. representative on the Council of International Civil Aviation Organization in July of 2010. He is a graduate of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he was in the ROTC program. And I would like to take a moment to not only recognize him as a veteran, but all the veterans who have served our country. So if you are retired or current active duty or reservist, I'd please ask you to stand and be recognized, and thank you for your service. Ambassador Wirth also has ties to the Omaha area, where he started an internet advertising company. And additionally, Ambassador Wirth is the former president of the Airline Pilots Association, as well as a pilot for Northwest Airlines. It is my great pleasure and honor to introduce U.S. Ambassador Dwayne Wirth.
Thank you very much, Scott, and for the invitation and the opportunity to be with you today. And I especially enjoyed earlier this afternoon when I see all the students in the room. I see a lot of you came back for another dose because we had a nice afternoon together, and it was a great opportunity for me to meet you and share my view of where we are today and what your future holds. And I, as Scott said, I think it's a bright one. I'm also glad that my family is here. I got my brother Lyle, Dr. Wirth, and another Dr. Wirth, his wife Ann, and their two sons, Carl and Christopher. So I'd like to welcome my brother. Would you give my brother and his wife a hand? They drove up from Lincoln. I was lucky enough to have Thanksgiving at home with our family. They entertained about 20 of us. I'm not sure why Ann is not unconscious. She did so much cooking and cleaning, but she made it as well. Scott gave the most recent resume that the State Department normally puts out, and some of that's in your brochure. But I'd like to start a little bit, since I'm in Nebraska, and I'm so glad to be back home in my home state, which I'm proud of, but to give you a little of the Nebraska heritage piece, if you will. And I didn't start out as an ambassador. I didn't start out as the president of the Airline Pilots Association. I started out at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln in 1966, and there's a little thing called, I told the students today, people ask me about how do you make a career choice that led down this way in aviation, and I shared with them that I made the choice not to be an Army lieutenant. That was the choice, because there's a land-grant college, you were required to attend ROTC in those days, and the war, you were going one way or the other, so you chose how to go. So I chose to be in the Air Force. I chose not to be in the Army, and that worked out for me. Learned to fly in Lincoln. And Lincoln, everybody likes to live in Lindbergh's shadow. We always mention Lindbergh learned to fly in Lincoln, so I guess we all have a little shadow of Charles Lindbergh. I'm going to come back to him a little bit in a moment because he was an airmail pilot, and I told the class about Charles Lindbergh there, but I got commissioned in 1970, went to the Air Force for 6 years, 15 in the Kansas Air National Guard, but along the way, I was an airline pilot, first for Braniff, and it failed, the first failure in the deregulation. 1982, Braniff failed, but I was lucky enough to get on with Northwest Airlines and had a great career there. Flew the 747 for nearly 20 years, which was a lot. And I want to recognize somebody else in the audience I just re-met, Ronnie Mitchell. You introduced him as our director here in Nebraska. Ronnie and I found out we already knew each other. We were in the same squadron and wing here at Offutt Air Force Base, the 55th Strat Wing, flew the RC-135 and Looking Glass, and worked for the same colonel who became a three-star general, General George Miller. So it's good to see you again, Ronnie, and nice to meet your wife. I want to tell you a little bit about the career at the Airline Pilots Association, which was really the launching pad of you would a political thing, because ALPA is a trade union, is very active in politics, and that's where I guess I cut my teeth in Washington, which I was there for nearly 20 years, 8 years as vice president of the Airline Pilots Association and 8 years as president. But a little something you should know about ALPA that was formed in 1931, people were just trying to stay alive. We weren't trying to make money. Money was good, but safety wasn't so good. And the survivability of pilots wasn't so good. So ALPA's, from my history and my cutting my teeth on why a lot of people wanted me to be the ambassador many years later of ICAO, because that's largely a safety organization. And ALPA, even though it's a trade union, is the largest non-governmental safety organization in the world. It is that big, and they put that much effort into it and money into it, and I was proud to be a part of it for so long. I was also interested to see that two of the top three when you started having this award, it was Captain Mimi Tompkins and Captain Al Haynes. Our friend from United will remember Al. Al was the captain of that plane that landed in Sioux City under a miracle. It was unbelievable. Anybody could fly that damaged DC-10 in those days, but that crew pulled off a miracle. It was like flying a brick, but they managed to fly a brick and get it on the ground and save a lot of people's lives. And Mimi was that, you remember, some of these students are going to be too young to remember this. There was an Aloha airplane. The 737, actually, the top of it peeled right off like you're peeling off a tin can of tuna. Peeled it right off. And they got that airplane on the ground. And Mimi Tompkins, I saw you gave Mimi the award in, I think, the second person to get the award. So I was happy to know those people and work with them. But I'm not your typical diplomat also or union leader. I guess I served on two airline boards of directors. I was 6 years on a Northwest Airlines board. Learned a lot about the airline business I thought I knew as a union president, but I didn't. So it's good of me to serve on a board in Hawaiian Airlines as well. And as Scott mentioned, had an unplanned entrepreneurial stint as one of the co-founders of a company here in Omaha called Sojourn. So I didn't have your typical background for a career foreign diplomat. And so if I'm undiplomatic, I just wasn't trained properly. So maybe the Aviation Institute can give me some training in how to be a better diplomat. But back to kind of the global theme, and I'm going to, unlike my visit with the enjoyable visit I had with the students today, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on the global side of it and what ICAO means to it. ICAO, and we are probably, aviation is the first really true global business, just the nature of it. And a requirement for interoperability of everything. Now, the internet certainly is, but in any other business, I can't think of anything that is so completely global, and so much political and global cooperation is required to make it safe and effective and efficient and make global trade work. So one thing you really need to know, it is unbelievably difficult to run an organization like ICAO where business intersects with politics. And if that's hard enough in a country, it's unbelievably with 190 nations in the world to make it all work together, but somehow we find a way to do it. I recently gave a couple of other speeches, and just to tell you, I think the importance of the industry that you guys represent in this institute and the students are about to enter. One speech was to, recently was to the United States Chamber of Commerce. They had a massive event in Washington. And their theme was called Flying Towards Economic Growth, which I thought was totally appropriate because there's no bigger driver of the world's economy than international aviation. It counts for several $1 trillion every year. When you think of all the economic activity that doesn't happen if you couldn't fly internationally, all the businesses that wouldn't be around. FedEx is actually a global supply chain. It's not delivering letters. It's delivering car parts. It's delivering computer parts. It's unbelievable what aviation does. Next, about the following week after that, was a speech to the American Bar Association, the Air and Space Law Forum. Lawyers get involved in everything, I found out. Air and space law. But nonetheless, they had a whole different cut on what the Chamber of Commerce has a view how to drive the economy. Lawyers have a view on how to keep it orderly and obey everybody, respect everybody's sovereignty, but have international law. We're cooperative, but and there's an intersection there that doesn't always get along. And then just a week after that, when my wife and I came back from several weeks in China, I gave a speech to the Aerospace Industries Association, 250 aerospace CEOs for all the manufacturing. That's the Boeing, it's the Pratt & Whitney, it's the Honeywells, it's the Raytheon, it's all aerospace, defense and civil. And they've got a view, of course, how to keep and protect American jobs and run our defense industry and as well as our civil industry, which is all intersected. And again, one of the world's largest and most successful businesses in which the United States still has a commanding role, nearly 40% of a market. It used to be more than that, but we used to be not have as much competition, but that's still a giant business and probably the last domain where the United States still has a manufacturing presence, and not only a manufacturing presence, is the leading manufacturer in the world of this very cutting edge and important in work. So I think we're all should be proud of the aerospace and the industry of the United States of America. It's really the best. So now I'm also proud to be here as the United States ambassador. In spite of the circuitous route I took to get here through the private sector, I got here anyway. But a lot of you are probably asking still, even though, what is ICAO? You heard it's the International Civil Aviation Organization, but don't be embarrassed if you don't really know or haven't heard of it. Because when I actually told some of my family and my good friends when I first got the call, when you're getting vetted to be in a presidential appointment, it's all secret. The problem is they ask about 300 people about you, so everybody, the secrets gets out. But nonetheless, you're not supposed to talk about it. It's a big secret. And then when you're finally vetted and the president makes an announcement, then you got to go to a Senate confirmation hearing. But right after the announcement came out and before the hearing, I started calling my family and letting them know there's going to be a change in my life because the president had nominated me. My friends on Capitol Hill told me I wouldn't have any trouble being confirmed. So it looked like I was going to be the United States Ambassador to ICAO. And there was this kind of silence. And they're either Googling it or it might be my Aunt Sylvia. My 95-year-old Aunt Sylvia, really quiet, she says, is that an island in the Pacific or is that in the Caribbean? I never remember where ICAO was. And I said, no, Aunt Sylvia, it's not an island. I'll explain it to you. And then it wasn't as bad as a cousin whose joke that he didn't realize that a Scandinavian furniture store needed a U.S. ambassador. I said, no, that's IKO, not IKEA. So I had my Rodney Dangerfield moment when I was a United States ambassador. So that was probably good. Nothing like your hometown boys to bring you back down to earth. But ICAO is probably the most important agency and United Nations type agency that nobody's ever heard of if you're not in aviation. What it's done for global standards and safety and security and make a global business run is really kind of remarkable. It was formed in 1941 out of a convention in Chicago, hence the Chicago Convention. And it had a remarkable success, especially when you're thinking about We had visionaries in those days who actually understood what aviation could be, what it could mean after World War II. Because just 5 years prior, airplanes couldn't fly across the Atlantic Ocean nonstop. They couldn't go at high altitude. There wasn't a B-29. What aviation, the jet engine, even though it was only in German airplanes, they saw the future was going to be unbelievable. And then to prevent further war and have international trade, they needed to have global standards to be safe, and that everybody had to share in his prosperity somehow, and they had enough vision to actually form something when the war wasn't over. Now remember, this was 1944, and they're having this convention in Chicago. So interestingly enough, I got to meet in 1999 the United States lead negotiator at the Chicago Convention. Secretary Rodney Slater, President Clinton's Department of Transportation Secretary is a good friend, and he actually held a 55th anniversary of the Chicago Convention. He did in Chicago, kind of replicated it. And his idea was, what can we do better? How can we liberalize regimes? Can we have better safety? So he replicated the Chicago Convention in 1999. And a young fellow named, well, he wasn't that young, L. Welch Pogue, was the U.S. lead negotiator at the time. The Civil Aeronautics Board had just been formed, and he was the head of that. And there was a small team, but he was the leader of it. Another Nebraska connection. Guess where he graduated? University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Guess where his wife's from? Fremont, Nebraska. Guess where she graduated? University of Nebraska-Lincoln. See, what a great state, University of Nebraska, and university it really is. Well, he was 100 years old in 1999. He was just like Yoda. He was this little guy. But he was wise like Yoda, and everybody hung on his every word, and I know I did. I wanted to meet this guy. I've been working in IFALPA and ALPA long enough to be involved with ICAO by this time for quite a few years, and everybody had kind of the same kind of questions for Mr. Pogue, and some of those came about, how did you guys figure out how to write a convention that has survived, now it's 68 years, in those days it was less than 68, with almost no amendments, it's not very thick, especially when you're all lawyers. How did you write a pamphlet that is a convention, that is a treaty, that has survived this long, that had all these countries in it, and you all have abided by it, lived by its rules, and got along? That's an extraordinary achievement. Well, Mr. Pogue's words were, he had a couple of reasons for it. One, we knew enough to keep it simple because we knew what we didn't know. We knew we had no idea the technology, what was going to happen, what it would look like, so we kept it simple. The second reason was we didn't have time to screw it up. There was a war on, and we had to get this, the Chicago Convention, over with. The third thing they had, was very smart, is that they knew they had to make this a consensus-based organization, not have very many really votes. Because remember, not just because of the war, but they understood this was nation, member states would be members of ICAO, not organizations. This was states would belong to it, like the United Nations would be. And states would be jealous of their sovereignty. They are now, but imagine after World War II how jealous of their sovereignty and worried about airspace they might be. So they knew if we didn't have an overwhelming consensus, there was no point in having a vote where you won 51% or 49% because you couldn't enforce. You couldn't make people do this against their will. So you had to have an organization that had the patience to build consensus. And they did that. So they were very successful in this. This Chicago Convention has only been amended a couple of times in 68 years. I don't know of any other treaty or convention that hasn't gone through dozens of amendments in 68 years. But the Chicago Convention, which formed ICAO, has stood the test of time. Well, I should probably give you a little bit about the governance of it as well, because it's like a United Nations organization in that there's 190 nations that are part of ICAO. But the 190 nations only get together once every 3 years for a couple of weeks in what's called a General Assembly. It started out as only 50 countries, but now there's 190. There's a council, which I'm the United States ambassador to this council. It started out as only 15 countries, but now it's up to 36. I'm going to tell you why that has become a little bit of a challenge for the United States. Unlike the Security Council, there's no permanent members. We've always been on it, but we have to run every 3 years for election like everybody else does. And before, we were one of 15. Now we're one of 36. And there's regional blocks of votes. There's 8 Africans, there's 8 Europeans, there's 8 Latins, there's Middle Eastern people. And it's a big political organization. And it's difficult to maintain U.S. leadership when you're constantly working with, and hopefully working with, but sometimes, let's face it, there's commercialization, there's competition amongst nations, there's competitions with Europe, there's growing competition with China and Russia and India and all the BRICS, Brazil as well. So it's to have the U.S. leadership maintain in aerospace and aviation and on the political realm and get what we need for our jobs, our economy, our goals is an ever-increasing challenge. It's also, there's a world of opportunity for you students all over, but have the focus in back narrowly on the United States. It's harder and harder for the United States to put the effort in to protect our jobs, protect our interests, and get what we need. Asia has become a very gigantic pivot point. Asia will be the largest market in the world very soon, if it's not already when you combine it all together. The United States by itself has been the largest for a long time. You add the transatlantic, that has been the largest. That's going to be ancient history. Asia, between Singapore and Japan and Korea and China, is going to eclipse us as the largest market in the world. And you add that to what's going on in India and parts of Latin America and Brazil. We're going to have a strong economy and success, but we're kind of mature. And the rest of the growth is in other parts of the world, which is opportunity for our students, but a growing challenge for U.S. commerce, U.S. industries, U.S. jobs, U.S. companies, and I guess for U.S. Politicians in some degree as well. The ICAO mission has evolved. When it started out in 1944, it was really almost all about safety. There was a consensus we needed to be safe because it wasn't a safe industry then. There's all kinds of accidents and more predicted. There weren't international standards. Frequencies weren't the same. Runways weren't the same. Communications wasn't the same. Air traffic management wasn't the same. It's a miracle that the industry worked at all. But they worked through that with a big consensus to make everything the same. So you could go from Duluth, Minnesota, to Bangkok, to Cape Town, South Africa, and you could expect the same. Everything should work together. No matter who manufactured it, the standard should be the same so that everything would work. It was when you think of when they started and did this in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, we take that kind of interoperability for granted today, but take it back to when they got this started, it was quite an achievement. So on the safety side, which is still our core business of ICAO, everything that has the word air in it, airport, airplane, air navigation, air communication, air traffic rights, if it has the word air in it, we have a standard for it. It's unbelievable how many annexes we could fill up the Library of Congress with all the annexes we have to make sure that there's a standard and we can force compliance with ICAO standards. Right, it is this week, I think Becky was at, we have a global NAV conference going on in Montreal right now. I'm glad to be home with the family and with you people, but this is going on right now. Almost 1,300 delegates from around the world are there for over 2 weeks trying to pound out a new international agreement for, imagine this, a whole plan for air navigation for the entire planet Earth, dividing up the airspace, who's responsible for what, how the next technology is going to come in line and what schedule, how much it will cost, who's going to pay for it. With 190 countries trying to work this out, have you ever bargained with one-on-one for something this important? This is a real enterprise, but I think we're going to be successful. It's really a challenge, but there's a small reason why we need to be challenged. We will not get the next generation, I'm going to talk about that in a minute, of air transportation separation. When we go to satellites and when radar is almost a thing of the past, radar is redundant for traffic separation. It's all going to be done through satellites and through the equipment in the airplane. That's going to free up the air like nothing before. But just to go through the next 10 years of the upgrades that we're going to apply before we get full-blown next generation, I'll describe that in a minute, is like $120 billion. I mean, even for Warren Buffett, that's a lot of money. Even our friend Warren would think that's a certain amount of money. But that's a lot of money to invest. If it's not done with an agreement that everybody's on the same plan, trying to do the understanding we have the same technologies that are going to be compatible with each other, we're just going to have a lot of wasted effort here if we don't iron out this agreement. So hopefully by this end of this week and we go to the next General Assembly of ICAO, which is next fall, we'll be able to have an international agreement which will really finally give us 21st century air traffic management, and which will open up an enormous amount of productivity and save money for U.S. consumers, U.S. companies, and it's actually be safer as well. We have, that's on that part, I want to come back to next gen. You've heard the term, I know our students have next generation air traffic management. Let me give you a statistic, and why this is so far, why it's needed, not just for safety, but efficiency. What we've lost is any semblance of what the jet age was supposed to bring us in efficiency and productivity. A good friend of mine is Richard, the chairman and CEO of Anderson, Richard Anderson of Delta. We've been together for over 20 years, at Northwest, now he's at Delta. He uses this analogy, so I'm stealing his statistics. If I gave you a question and said, in 1955, actually 1952, you could take a DC-6 from Atlanta, Georgia, and a scheduled flight time to LaGuardia. Now compare in 2012, take a Boeing 777 and go from Atlanta, Georgia, to St. Martin, LaGuardia. Which do you think has the shortest flight time? Well, I told you it was a trick question. It was a DC-6. And why could that be? How could the block time from Atlanta to LaGuardia be shorter on a DC-6? Because you lost 40 to 45 minutes in ground time now in either LaGuardia or in Atlanta. So that tells you something right there. I think that shows it. We've lost that much productivity out of aviation, which is the joke of if you've got time to spare, go by air. Aviation people don't find that funny. I don't find that funny. But that's the kind of system we have been living with and take as normal, these unbelievably long block times, and because of all the efficiency in air traffic control system. It's airspace. We cannot manage airspace with this much capacity without changing into a system by satellites and with the equipment on board plus automated surveillance band radar, when we will actually be able to go, there almost won't be these airways anymore. Everybody will have an individual flight plan. You can avoid bad weather. You're not going to be stopped by a thunderstorm over the Midwest. Just shut you down. You'll be able to work with it. There's literally $9 to $10 billion lost every year in extra costs just by delays. We've learned to live with year after year after year. This is the 21st century should allow us to do it more efficiently. The technology is here. I used this in Desert Storm 20 years ago. The military was using it a long time ago. We had four-dimensional air traffic separation with airplanes and Tomahawk missiles and everything else in the first Gulf War. That same it's not a question of technology. The technology is old that we're about to install now. But we have to get to the next thing. It's partly politics. It's not a technological problem. The technology exists. It's a political will and agreement among nations and aviation industry to just make the decision and get this thing up and running. Besides safety, there's thousands of safety issues. I won't certainly attempt to cover them all. But the other mission creep, and I call it mission creep because there's no consensus here. ICAO was used to be pure safety, as I said. But now, after 9/11, we got a security responsibility, have security standards for the world. Interestingly enough, there's not that big a consensus on security that you might expect. After 9/11, everybody must totally get it about aviation security. Wrong. From 2001 until the underwear bomber in 2009, there was almost no changes in worldwide aviation security standards. The United States imposed its own on anybody coming to the United States. However, all the worldwide system had holes in it all over the place, which the underwear bomber, you might remember, he was the Christmas bomber. It came in on Delta from Amsterdam, but he boarded in Lagos, Nigeria, got to Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, and was coming to the United States. Why this turned out to be a different wake-up call was fairly simple, actually. First of all, they finally found out it wasn't, even though he was coming to the United States, when you board in Schiphol, even a Delta airplane, there were citizens from 21 countries on that airplane. They weren't just Americans. And two-thirds of them were from the Middle East, because Schiphol's they connect from Africa to the Middle East a lot. That's a huge connecting airport from the Middle East. And they finally woke up and said, oh, my gosh, these guys are going to be after everybody. We really need to get on board. So Secretary Napolitano, our Homeland Security Secretary under President Obama, did a marvelous job of rounding up world support. She became a real road warrior, almost like Secretary Clinton, rounding up support. So by the last assembly, when I first became ambassador, we were able to really take some dramatic new action and get some worldwide standards for aviation security. We followed that up just a couple weeks ago. I'm the new chairman of the Aviation Security Committee of ICAO. Where we actually fast-tracked a whole bunch of stuff for cargo, because you might remember the Yemen incident when they sent printer ink cartridges through Yemen on FedEx and UPS. Thank God they didn't go off either. But so now we have new cargo security standards. We just did that a couple of weeks ago. So we're behind on security, but the consensus is finally coming together in the need to have a global system. But you may be surprised, I certainly was, how far behind 11 years after 9/11, which we're still playing catch up on security, which is an ICAO international responsibility. The last issue that we deal with in ICAO is the environment. And environment and climate change and all those things involving it, carbon emissions. Now, ICAO had a big consensus on noise. We have noise standards for engines. We were dealing with noxic particles of carbon emissions prior to that. This isn't anything new. But what's new is the politics of climate change. And everybody's for climate change, but not everybody wants to pay for what it takes to reduce the climate change. And there's other ways to do it. The United States we should be proud of our nation's got about a smaller carbon footprint as we've had in 20 years. Some of that has nothing to do with aviation. That has something to do with the fracking. But aviation itself, we're 15% below where we were 10 years ago. More fuel-efficient airplanes, better air traffic management. That's a remarkable statistic in Europe, so increased by 30%. We're 15% below where we were 10 years ago. We're trying to do it mostly with technology, and other nations have another point of view. European Union, I'm going to spend some time with this. Those of you who've been following this, there's been we came pretty close to having a full-blown trade war over the carbon emission taxes the European Union was trying to impose unilaterally. Now, the Obama administration consistently said you won't find a president who's more committed to climate change and doing it, but we couldn't tolerate unilateral action. The president always said you have the right goal with the wrong way to accomplish that goal. We can't have unilateralism. A multilateral world requires the patience to have an international agreement where everybody understands and everybody participates. You should know that the European Union at the United States leadership did recently withdraw. You might say they may be forced to, but I will give them some credit. They saw the wisdom of withdrawing their enforcement of their carbon tax, and we're going to review it in a year. But I think we will end up getting a global agreement on a timeline that we can participate with. I think the United States will play a large role in that, and I'm very happy to have been part of that because this was going to a bad place. But you should know that the agreement on climate change is still a far from an easy path. You may not be aware of, if you know what the UNFCCC is, the United Nations on Climate Change, you have a big convention, basically the Kyoto Protocol, which the United States never ratified. President Clinton agreed to it. The United States Senate never ratified it. Its 20th anniversary was just last year. And now Russia's left, Canada's left, and Japan's left. Nobody's less interested in climate change. Nobody thinks climate change is less important, certainly not the United States. The problem with the Kyoto Protocol and then the UNFCCC, the convention followed, it divided the world up this way. Developed countries like the United States and Canada and Europe, Japan, had total responsibility for climate change. They're going to come up with protocols and taxes and money and targets and whatever it costs to meet this, no matter how much economic activity you had to suppress, that was your duty as a developed country. Developing country, which was 80% of the world, had no responsibility. That was always doomed, wasn't it? That was why the United States Senate probably never finally ratified it, in spite of commitment to fight climate change and to reduce emissions and to be responsible citizens of the world. That bright line of 100% responsibility and no responsibility wasn't a political reality that everybody could live with. So we're working hard in the United States is to come up with a new agreement on climate change that the whole world, and especially the economies of the today, China is going to be the world's largest economy. India and all these other countries are going to have to play in the same arena. And if they do, I think we can come to agreement on climate change. But this has taken over a big part of ICAO's politics, and it is hugely political. But I think we're going to work our way through it. And I think the Obama administration did a good job of carefully negotiating this with Europe and finding a way to avoid a trade war and still have the right answer. So I was happy to be part of that. I do want to spend a moment as I work towards conclusion here. Again, more talking to the students and kind of reinforcing the message I gave you, I think, today, those of you who were in the classroom today. The United States and a lot of North America and Europe are fairly mature economies and have a mature industry. It's still going to be a great job in this industry in our country and in Europe and the transatlantic. But I started to tell you this afternoon, the growth opportunities are going to be in Asia. The growth opportunities are going to be in the Middle East. The growth opportunities may occur in other parts of Latin America. But as a global business, these same companies will be Pratt & Whitney is a global company. Boeing's a global company. Airbus is a global company. 55% of Airbus 320s will be made in the United States of America. Boeing has been made all over the world, not just the 787. Manufacturing is all over the world. The airlines will merge internationally. Right now, it's just consolidating domestically, but we'll see international mergers. We'll see the foreign ownership laws be amended. So we're going to have an industry where your nationality and your citizenship and your employment are going to get blurred. And that's okay. As long as you know what you're doing and what you want, you'll be able to succeed and even thrive with your education and your commitment and your skills. That's good for you. It's not going to be your father's Oldsmobile. It's not going to be the career path that I had safely ensconced in the United States of America. Even though I traveled all over the world, I was always a U.S. employee based and had the protection of U.S. labor law. I think your lives will be different, but your lives can be even more prosperous if you ride that wave, use your skills in this education, and are open to what a global industry can be. What I'm a part of right now will help make those standards possible so that everybody has these equal opportunities, and those with the best education will win. And those of you who are lucky enough to be involved with the Aviation Institute here in Omaha, in the great state of Nebraska, which has taken a leadership role in this, I'm happy to be with here tonight. I'm hoping you have a bright future, and I want to thank you for inviting me, Scott. I really enjoyed our time. Thank you.
I would now like to ask our founding director, Bill Shea, and past director, Scott Terry, to please join me on stage for the presentation of the William F. Shea Award for Distinguished Service.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here to see everyone again. And what an honor to have the ambassador here tonight. It's just fantastic. How about another great hand for such a great speech? The University of Nebraska at Omaha Aviation Institute William F. Shea Award for Distinguished Contribution to Aviation. In recognition of extraordinary contributions to the field of air transportation, this honor is bestowed on Ambassador Duane Wirth, and I might say a great American. Congratulations.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Duane Wirth, United States Representative on the Council of the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, which develops and promotes standards and practices for the safety, security, and environmental sustainability of international civil aviation. Ambassador Wirth has delivered the 2012 Charles W. Durham Distinguished Lecture, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Aviation Institute. He is also this year's recipient of the William F. Shea Award for Contributions to Aviation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 27th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.